Hello, everybody, and thank you so much, Mary. I can't tell you how humbled I am to be opening the 85th celebration of the birth of AA. Zoom, the first ever Zoom. You know, I'm humbled because you're all here from all over the world, and I'm humbled because of the event itself. I will tell you it's very strange to do this. There's the way they have it set up is I'm basically looking at just myself, but I realized this morning sitting alone in a room speaking nervously to myself was something I'm pretty good at, so I'll just go with that. But it feels a little different today. I have a passion for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have from my very first year, not from my very first day, which was May 16th, 1993. That's my sobriety date, by the grace of God. Completely, but I've had a passion for it as it's changed my inner life, and it's changed the lives of the people around me, and it's changed the breadth of love that I've been able to experience, and more importantly, been able to give because of the gift of AA. So I was looking at the history of AA. I'm lucky enough to have a sponsor who's my grand sponsor, J.S., who's a historian of AA, so I know something about it, but I wanted to see what they Mother's Day was in 1935, and it was May 12th. And as most of you probably know, that's the day that Bill Wilson first ever really carried the message of what he had learned about how to recover from alcoholism to Dr. Bob. I know it's not our Founders Day, which is June 10th, but it's an important day, Mother's Day, because Bob finally showed up to Henrietta Seidelings, and Bill was able to sit with him. And the way Bill did it was so beautiful and artful. And the reason I looked it up is because my brother carried the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to me on Mother's Day in 1993, which was May 9th. I had just ruined Mother's Day for my parents and for my mother and for my family. My mother was in her 70s and terminally ill and had less than a year to live. Was believed at the time she lived a couple more years, but we thought it was her last Mother's Day. I was invited to Mother's Day, and nobody had seen me for months. They didn't know how I was living, and I was basically sitting in an apartment near the ocean in Redondo Beach, California, drinking myself to death. And my circumstances were I had lost the last job that was beneath me. I always like to say that another job I was too good for. I got fired from somehow as an alcoholic. I was desperately alone, although many people would have loved to have loved me. I had drank myself out of my favorite job I've ever had, which was playing lead guitar in a rock and roll band. I was I was about to become a parent. I was 31 years old, and there was an 18-year-old girl across town from me who was pregnant with my child. My mother was 2 miles away dying of cancer, and I couldn't seem to visit her. I apparently would call her occasionally and say I was coming to visit her, but I never showed up. And I was tens of thousands of dollars in debt, and I was unemployable, and I never saw the beach that was right across the street from my apartment. I didn't pay rent on that apartment. I was about to be evicted. And none of this is why I'm here. None of this is why I need recovery. Those to the circumstances that Alcoholics Anonymous or alcoholism brought to me. I started off with every advantage. I had beautiful, loving parents. My parents were married to each other for almost 50 years, I think 49 and three quarters years when my mother passed away. I had brothers and sisters who loved me. I was the youngest of four in an Irish Catholic family, which is a lovely place to grow up. There's stories and love and music and lots of laughter. It was just wonderful. But on, in May 1993, you know, on Mother's Day, I was a hollow, hollow person. And the reason I needed recovery is because I could not stop drinking. And I wanted to. And I know there are lots of people on this Zoom meeting today. And I, my experience from being in Akron is there are lots of people from all over the world. But I have a feeling that a lot of you who can hear me are or see me had the same experience. My last 6 months of drinking, I didn't want to drink anymore. I would wake up every morning and say, please, Matthew, please don't drink today. don't drink today. Go see that girl's parents today and tell them you're a stand-up guy. Go visit your mother today. Do your laundry. Open your windows. Get a job. This would all come through my mind if I when I woke up in the morning or in the afternoon or in the middle of the night, whenever I woke up. And I know now from being involved in Alcoholics Anonymous steadily for 27 years and sponsoring many, many men and seeing people in AA all over the world that I might as well have said when I woke up in the morning, Matthew, hold back the Pacific Ocean today. Because I didn't have the power to stop drinking, which was repeatedly proven to me because I had the obsession of the mind. The way I felt, the way it was for me is the last several months of my drinking, I knew that if I thought about alcohol in an attractive way at all, I had to drink it. I knew that once it was in my mind that it would be okay, that it might be okay, that it wouldn't cause more problems. I was right next door to the liquor store on, you know, Redondo Beach Avenue. I just walked over there and was drinking again, usually by 9:30 or 10 in the morning or within an hour after I woke up. So on Mother's Day, what happened to me was I had intended, when my brother said, hey, he called me up and said, tomorrow's Mother's Day. I want you to know that it may be Mom's last Mother's Day. I want to make sure you can make it. And I also, I'm going to come and pick you up. And I remember immediately being offended, like, why would he think I'm not going to make it? It's Mother's Day. I love my mother. I respect my mother. But I didn't know I was calling and not showing up, you know. I was so full of self-loathing and self-hatred that I would probably have the best intention to show up. But then I couldn't bring the thought of bringing me to somebody else. I couldn't do it. And my brother said, you know, I'm going to come pick you up. And my intention was, when he called me the day before Mother's Day, which was May 8th of 1993, the day that Dr. Bob was sleeping under the living dining room table, the day before Mother's Day in 1935, my intention was, I'm gonna go get some flowers. I'm gonna write a great card. I'm gonna take a shower, wash my clothes. I love my mom. I'm gonna make this real special. If it's Mom's last Mother's Day, I'm gonna make it perfect for her from her youngest son. And I was the youngest by many years. I had a very special relationship with my parents, and I was oblivious that I hadn't seen him in almost 7 months. Totally oblivious. And that was my intention. And I sat down on my couch, where I lived on my couch, and I poured myself some gin, you know, just to get ready to start to do all this stuff. And my brother honked his horn. And I'd been sitting there drinking for 17 hours, off and on. Drink, fall asleep, wake up, drink, pace around, smoke a cigarette, drink some more. And I never left. I never got that card. I never bought those flowers. I never changed my clothes. I didn't take a shower. And I was terrified. There he was outside the door. I don't know, as I'm grabbing a shirt to put on and I'm heading out the door, I don't know if they know I got fired from my job. I'm going to go see my family. I don't know if they know that Anna's pregnant. I don't know what they know, because all I ever did was lie. Back at the very end, the way alcohol took me from a privileged, beautiful life of love and some advantage. My parents both had to work really hard to be able to send me to college, but they did. They did it. They did the sacrifice. And by the time I got to that day, Mother's Day, I didn't know what they knew about me, because I didn't know who I said what to. And that, as I walked towards my brother's car, he looked up at me, and he looked like he had this startled look on his face, and I didn't know why. And I didn't know that standing there in front of his car in the hot sun in Redondo Beach, getting in his car, I weighed 108 pounds. I had deep black lines underneath my eyes. My cheeks were hollow. I was drunk. And I got in his car, and I went to Mother's Day, and I ruined it. And I don't know what I did. I have no idea what I did. I could see their faces, and I felt alienated from them, but I didn't know what I was saying or why I was saying it. And I asked my sister, who's a very, very good, my closest friend in the world, actually. I asked her about 5 years ago, so 22 years later, I asked her, what happened on Mother's Day? And she said, please, let's never speak of that. You were vile to our mother. And I can sit here today and honestly tell you, I don't know why I would do that. I don't know why I would be that way. I loved her. I respected her. There was never a time in my life where I didn't. I became a musician because my mother saw me clearly. We were very poor when my mother bought me my first guitar because I wasn't a good athlete and I wasn't getting picked first for the team and I was always up in my head and I loved to lay on the living room floor with the headphones on and listen to the Rolling Stones, Led Zeppelin, Beatles, and James Taylor. And she saw me. It wasn't what she wanted, but it's what I needed, you know. And for some reason, this wonderful woman who only gave me love, in my cups, in the depths of my disease, I was revolting to her, and apparently intentionally. And that was what I was like. My parents gave me such a beautiful example of love and kindness and marriage. They never even joked about anything but being dedicated to each other. And when that girl was 8.5 months pregnant, Anna, I pushed her down some stairs. And I didn't do that because I wanted to hurt her. I would never want to hurt anyone like that. I've never hurt a woman ever in my life. And I didn't do that because I wanted to hurt that baby. I never met that baby, and I didn't feel a lot of feelings about it, but I would never want to hurt an unborn child. But I was an alcoholic, and she wanted me not to drink that day, and she wanted me to go to the doctor with her. I thought she was screaming at me to stop drinking, and I just pushed her enough to get her out of the door. Then I realized, as I saw her face, I pushed her too hard, and I heard her go down the stairs as I slammed the door. And I always tell that part of the story because I want to tell you what I was really like. I didn't mean to hurt everybody I knew. I never had that intention. I didn't mean to do anything like that. I just couldn't stop drinking. And once I started drinking, I couldn't care less about you. So my brother drove me home from Mother's Day. And he dropped me off. We were having an argument, and he dropped me off, and I was so sick of him being my older brother and winning the argument, telling me what I should and shouldn't think and what I should and shouldn't do. Now, this is the arrogance and the self-centeredness of alcoholism, isn't it? My brother at that time was sober for 12 years. He was always at my mother's house. He was raising his children and being faithful to his wife. And I was locked up in an apartment, stealing, not working, lying, physically abusing a pregnant woman. And I thought I had the moral higher ground in this argument. The self-centered arrogance of alcoholism is astounding. At least it was in me. And when my brother left, I got so mad at him. And the more I think about this story, the more I think that grace was coming towards me. God was rushing towards me. I just had to surrender, and I didn't know that. I didn't know any of that. But I wanted to finish the fight with my brother. Those are the circumstances on Mother's Day that ultimately led to me sitting here talking to you. I wanted to finish the fight. I wanted to win the fight. So I called my brother back when he had time to get home, and I just started screaming at him about what it was like to be his brother. And doesn't he know what I've accomplished? I've traveled all over the world. I've played music. I played at CBGB's in New York City. I have 2 degrees. You know, I don't know what I said. I just let him have it. And he didn't get a chance to say a word. And I was just so at the end of my rope, so far down and screaming up from the chasm. And when I ran out of juice, you know, I ran out of motivation and words, he was just quiet. It was just quiet. And I listened for a minute on the phone, and I was holding a phone, and went to a cord on the phone that was sitting on the floor. And he said pretty quietly into the phone, he said, "Matthew, I think you have a problem with alcoholism." And I think of this as the turning point in my life, and I didn't intend to turn this way. I didn't intend to say what I was about to say. But for some reason, when my brother said that, out of my mouth came, "Of course I do." And that surprised me. Mostly because I didn't want to say that. I didn't want my brother to hear that. I had lied about that to many, many people, to myself, to band managers, to you know, I was engaged for a while, and I just was like, "No, I don't have a problem with alcohol." And my brother, I was used to lying to, but my brother said, "I think you have a problem with alcoholism." And I said, "Of course I do." And I didn't know it, but I took the first surrender that enabled the grace of my recovery. I didn't know that in order for me to open myself up to the grace that is always available, always, every moment of the day, of every second of the entire history of the universe, this grace is available. I didn't know that when I said, "Of course I do," that I worked the first step of Alcoholics Anonymous. I admitted, I surrendered, I conceded that I'm powerless. And my brother said, "Don't go anywhere," which I look back and think of the funniest thing he could have possibly said to me, because my plan was to move to the other end of the couch by fall. I wasn't going anywhere, ever. I never did. There was a liquor store right next door. That's where I went. And he said, "Don't go anywhere." And he raced to my house. And I feel like I really need to honor what he did, to honor what happened on Mother's Day in 1935, to honor what happened in the ensuing weeks, and the knowledge that they gathered as two founders of this program about how to do this important thing. My brother showed up at my house. He walked right in my apartment and said, "Let's go to the beach." And I'm assuming that the squalor and the smell of my apartment drove him out of my apartment. He said, "Let's go to the beach." And I grabbed some cigarettes and I followed him down to the beach, where I thought he was going to scream and yell at me and maybe even hit me to stop being the embarrassment of my family. And he did not do that. And the reason my brother raced over there, the reason my brother flew in his car to my house, is because of what you see in the big book, all through the big book. The most precious thing that someone who will have a successful recovery needs, and it's willingness. Willingness. Willingness is another surrender word. Willingness is the verb of humility. Willingness is so precious. And my brother knew that it's a small window sometimes with a guy who knew, who maybe just for the first time in his life admitted that he has alcoholism or is powerless. And he flew to my house and he took me down to the beach and we sat on this lifeguard stand and he looked at me and he did exactly what Bill and Bob taught him. Exactly what it says in the book Alcoholics Anonymous in the chapter Working with Others. He told me how he felt when we threw him out of the house for being a drunk and a ruinous whirlpool, a typhoon in my family. He was 18 years old and we threw him out of the house because his alcoholism was destroying us. And I was 11 when that happened. And I remember it well. And then he started talking to me about how he felt when his wife and son threw them out of their house. And I remember that day because he had no one left to talk to. So he called his 14-year-old brother, me, sobbing. And then he started telling me how he felt when he lived in his car. And I remember that because I was 16. I was playing a pretty good rock band in Redondo Beach, and we rehearsed at school. And the music teacher let us use the room. So I'd ask my dad if I could borrow his car early in the morning before he had to go to work and take my amplifier and my Stratocaster down to school and put it in the music room. But what I really did was I got up real early and I put my guitar and my amp in the music room, and then I drove around Redondo Beach looking for my brother. looking for his car. He's 16, 17 years old, and he's describing to me, sitting on this lifeguard stand, how he felt living in that car. And I didn't know it. It wasn't, I didn't intellectually figure it out. But during his telling me this, it slowly permeated into me that somebody on earth knew how I felt. Because my brother was describing how I felt sitting on that lifeguard stand, and how I felt sitting in that apartment, and how I felt when I slammed that door and went back to drinking as Anna fell down the stairs. And I know what it's like for all of you. I know what it's like for us. We can't believe that anyone knows how we feel. They don't know that we can't stop. They don't know that we probably hate ourselves more than they hate us. But we put on this face of arrogance and pride. We're going to win the argument and go home lonely. So what my brother did was what Bill and Bob figured out together. What Bill actually did on May 12th in the Gatehouse in 1935, my brother told me a little bit about his own experience, and he won my confidence. And he said, I said, you know, after I was smoking all these cigarettes, I was totally freaking out, and I'm listening to this, and my whole mood is changing. My whole experience of him is changing. And I finally said, you know, you're right. I need to go to AA. And my brother, he just laughed. He said, you're not going to AA. You're going to a hospital. And I said, I can't do that. I'm too busy. Anybody else too busy? I can't. I got a hospital. Like, how long am I going to go to a hospital? He said, I don't know, 30 days. I'm like, whoa. That seems a little extreme. I haven't left my apartment for 6 months. I'm wanted by the police. I owe tens of thousands of dollars to all sorts of people. I can't get a job. I can't be civil to anyone. I can't tell the truth. And I can't stop drinking. But 30 days seemed like a little much to ask for me. And I didn't think I had time. And I know there are people on this call who know exactly what I meant by that. And my brother ignored me. And on May 15th, 1993, he said, I'm going to come by tomorrow and pick you up. And we're going to go. I'll give you a call. And I stayed up all night drinking. And I was terrified of stopping. I pulled up, not all the stops. I pawned my last guitars and I stayed up all night. I passed out probably around 4:30. I hit my head against the wall and I passed out. I woke up kind of in an awkward position against the wall and the phone was ringing. And it was not my brother. I thought it was my brother. That's why I answered it. It wasn't him. It was a woman who said, your daughter was born a few hours ago and we haven't been able to reach you. And I forgot about them. So I got my car keys and I had to go find my car. And I was supposed to go to the hospital and see my daughter. But I'm a selfish and self-centered alcoholic. So I just drove to the hospital where I was born. And they weren't there. Because the whole world was born at Little Company of Mary, apparently, because that's where I was born. And I put my head on that steering wheel and I thought, I should just go home and kill myself. I can't even do this right. I can't even show up late for the birth of my daughter. And I decided that's what I was going to do. I had a gun. I had a bullet. And I put my head on the steering wheel and I turned the steering, the ignition of the car bounced. The whole thing bounced. It hadn't been driven much. It was a terrible car to begin with, AMC. And into my head came the name of the right hospital, out of the blue. And I think that's grace. I think that's the grace that permeates all things. I think that's the creative energy that gives life, that gave me that gift. and I didn't go home and shoot myself. I went to the hospital and ran up the stairs to try to find this woman and my daughter, and I wasn't prepared myself. I couldn't be prepared for what was about to happen. And I ran in, and Anna was glad to see me, and that humiliated me, because I remembered when I went in there what had happened. And then she came towards me, and she stopped, and she reached into a glass plexiglass box, and she handed me Phoebe Rose. One of the most beautiful things I'd ever seen. But I didn't feel anything. I didn't feel anything for Anna, and I didn't feel anything for Phoebe. I just saw them, and I could see that there was a light about them that I didn't have, that I was never going to have. And I realized that I was not good, I was awful, and I was going to destroy whatever this is, this beautiful thing that I can't even relate to that's happening right in front of me. I didn't feel love and connection. I felt disgust and revulsion within myself for whatever they were. Their beauty was shamed me. So I did decide to go home and kill myself. And on the way out the door of that hospital, I prayed that I would never see them again, because I would hurt them, and because I couldn't be a father, and because I wasn't going to be a son, and I wasn't going to be a brother anymore. I wasn't going to be anybody's terrible, troublesome friend. And I got home, and I ran up my stairs to my apartment, and my brother standing on my porch. Grace, if he weren't there, I wouldn't be here. He was standing right in front of my door with a duffel bag in his hand. He said, "I packed your stuff. Let's go." And I tried to get his permission to go to my apartment. And he said, "No, you don't need anything in there." This little surrender, this little admission, "Of course I do. Of course I'm powerless." And this whole event, series of events happened of grace. The hospital came into my head. I saw the stunning beauty of Anne and Bibi and felt my own self-loathing. I got home and there was my brother. So that's what I was like. That's what happened. And I went in that hospital and I was terrified. I didn't have my medicine and I had to face people that I didn't know. And I didn't like that. And the most scary day of my life compared to that day was 30 days later when I got out, because I wasn't going to make it out there, but I was healthy and good. You know, I'd gained a lot of weight in the hospital. I guess we did some stuff, so I don't really remember, but my brother took me home, 2-hour drive, picked me up and took me home and dropped me off at my apartment. He told me to go to an AA meeting. I lied and said, "Yeah, I'm going to, that's what I'm doing. I'm going to an AA meeting. I'm not going to an AA meeting. I just spent 30 days in the hospital. I have a brand new baby. My mother's dying. I have stuff to do. I'm sober now, man. I got 30 days. And I opened up my door to my apartment, which was strangely unlocked. And somebody handed me a beer. And in my house, there was a party going on. And I lived there by myself. And no one ever came to visit me. But my lower companions had found out I was gone, and they broke into my apartment. And they had a long, long party. And I backed out of that apartment, and I put that beer on the porch, and I ran to a payphone, and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous out there, I don't want to lie to you. I did not do that because I had a foundation of recovery. I barely was awake in the hospital. I was just waking up. And I did not do that because I had a higher power that was taking care of me consciously with a connection. I backed out of that apartment because in 1 second, looking into that party with that beer in my hand, thinking a second before that, I'm thinking, "I'm never going to drink again. I'm going to stay sober forever." I got this beer in my hand. I'm looking at this apartment full of people. And just into my mind again, just for a second, pops the thought, "Matthew, all you've got that's of any value to you is 30 days of sobriety. You don't have self-respect. You don't have any character. You don't have any prospects. You're never going to be solvent again. You're never going to be employable again. But you got one thing, and it's 30 days, and it was the most precious thing. And I didn't even realize it till somebody put a beer in my hand. And I ran away from my own house. And I ran to a payphone, and I called AA. And now I want to tell you about what it's like. It was interesting to me that that day that I called AA, actually, this is a great AA story. I called AA from a payphone and kind of threw up on the guy. I was like, oh, baby, rock star, cool. I just wasn't really very coherent. And I called him and called AA, and I was yelling about all my circumstances. And the guy said, hold on, where are you? And I told him the corner I was standing on. He said, hold on a second. He's flipping through papers. I can hear him on the phone. And he says, wow, that's really weird. And I said, what's that? And he said, there's an AA meeting right across the street from where you're standing. And it starts in 15 minutes. It's everywhere. Grace is everywhere. That's my experience. That's my strength. That's my hope. And I asked the guy after he told me there was an AA meeting right across the street from where I was standing, I asked him, what do you think I should do? I mean, that was great. You were having a meeting, but like, I just explained, I have real problems, you know? And he said, you should go to that meeting. And I did. And I didn't hear anything. I heard wah, 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 wah. I mean, the speaker was very nicely dressed. He stood at the podium and he said, wah, 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 wah. I mean, my head was aflame with self-centeredness. And on the way out the door, somebody grabbed me and said, I know you, you're Neil's little brother. And I said, yeah. And he goes, I'll give you a ride home. And I couldn't go home. And he did the thing that I thought was the worst thing anyone could do for me. And for them, he dropped me off at my parents' house. And I didn't want to go to my parents' house because my perception of that was it would be awful for them. It would be so embarrassing that their 31-year-old son, with a baby across town with a teenage girl, with a ruined musical career, who couldn't get a real job, fresh out of rehab, is going to show up on their doorstep tonight. It's unthinkable the humiliation I would be bringing to them. And wow. How embarrassing and uncomfortable for me. So I don't want to go there. But my brother was from a good AA group. And while my mother was sick and my father was scared, they saw to my parents. They helped with chores. They did things around my parents' house. And he knew where my parents lived, and he drove me to my parents' house. And I walked in there, and I started my life in the most uncomfortable place I could possibly think of. And this is how I work step two. Because step two says came to believe. It doesn't say decided to believe. It doesn't say figured out that I should believe. It says I came to believe. It's a natural process of experience to come to believe something. And my experience was I woke up the next day in my parents' house terrified. My mother's strapped to an oxygen tank. My father's freaking out about losing the love of his life. I am so uncomfortable. I know they're finding out all this stuff I was up to when I was out there. I know that's all coming down. I woke up in the morning and said, hey, I got this directory and there's a meeting at 7. Can I borrow the car? And my dad said, if you want to go to a meeting, you don't even ask me. You just take the car. And I go, okay. Because they knew. They knew what you do. They watched. You know, I'm going to go off on a tangent here. Sandy Beach said once in a talk, you know, Bill, you say that Bill had a spiritual experience in Towns Hospital, like it was a finite experience. And I know people have made fun of that experience. I know that people said to Bill Wilson, how was your hot flash, Bill? And what I want to say to anybody who poo-poos the experience that Bill had at Towns Hospital, no matter what it was, whether it was biological, physiological, spiritual, psychological, it changed our lives. It changed the whole world. We're here because of that. And that experience, that a spiritual experience, didn't stop in Towns Hospital. It just flowed forward. It went to the gatehouse with Dr. Bob. It went to the next man. It crossed the ocean. It circumvented the globe. And it brought me hope and grace in May of 1993. And it's never stopped. I have never stopped reaping the benefits of surrendering to Alcoholics Anonymous and this amazingly spiritually fundamental program of action, spiritual action, not material action. That's second, spiritual action. So I just started going to meetings really uncomfortably because I wanted to get out of my parents' house because it made me crazy. I was 31 years old. I've been on the road for years with different bands, and now I'm living in my old bedroom at my parents' house. It was humiliating. And I get to the meeting, and you guys were a little bit too much for me. You're all happy, and you know, you have some secret. I don't have the secret. You all know something. I don't know what it is. So I just sat there uncomfortably. And then I'd run home to my parents' house because I have nowhere to go in town that's safe for me. And then I'd get uncomfortable after a few hours with my mom and my dad, and I'd drive to another meeting at noon and shake through that. I wasn't shaking like a newcomer. I was shaking like a self-centered ball of nerves. And you know how I came to believe? I didn't even know it. I didn't even notice it. I started to really like being with you. And I didn't know why. And I started to love being with my parents. And it wasn't comfortable. My mother would go to sleep at night and my father would sob in my arms. My mighty father, he's a World War II hero. He's a Bronze Star, my dad. And he was crying on my shoulder saying, what will I do without Dorothy? So we had to do things for my mom that were uncomfortable for all of us. But I started to love it. There was a love in that house and a love between them and a love for me that I just had never been awake to. That's what AA does. That's what spiritual action does. It wakes you up. And I got a sponsor. We did my second step. I came to believe by realizing I was comfortable with you. I was comfortable with them. I had no way to move forward. I was still lonely. You know how it says, you know, in As Bill Sees It, we just read it yesterday, so that's why I know it's in my mind. You know, at first we find the fellowship and our social loneliness is dispelled. But nothing really changes for us until we do these steps. And I did the third step on the floor of my sponsor's kitchen, holding his hand, saying that prayer. It was not comfortable. I didn't want to do it. I didn't feel elevated. But when I stood up from that prayer, I thought, I do feel different because I just did something I really didn't want to do, to try to be better, to try to live a different way. And that was enough that day. And you know where I dispelled my loneliness? It's one of my favorite quotations from a certain writer, Anthony DeMello. Anthony DeMello says, loneliness is not dispelled by contact with other people. Loneliness is dispelled through contact with the truth. And when I did a fourth step and a fifth step, I came into contact with the truth. And it wasn't comfortable, but it was perfect. Because the uncomfortable truth dispelled my loneliness. It shrank the chasm between you and me. I no longer believed that if you really knew who I was, you would hate me. Because I told somebody exactly who I was. And they responded with love. And I went into a room where everyone in the room was doing that, or had done that, or was about to do that. And we all loved each other. And I was not lonely anymore, as far as that spiritual chasm went. And I just started throwing myself into these steps, and I don't have very much more time. I want to tell you some very important things about recovery for me. The deeper I go working with other people, which keeps me in the book and in the steps and in the whole, I'm sorry, my hair is so long, it's a quarantine haircut. I'm in the whole thick of everything. And if I read that book with another guy, those steps and the conversations we have grow. They get deeper than the ocean. They get wider than the sky. You know, six and seven, you know, that has been tremendously important to me over 27 years. I want to tell you how I met the people in my life that changed my life. I was my sponsor. I got this job through to caring about another person. I asked the guy how he was doing when he visited the meeting that he'd only been to once before. He was impressed with that. I went and tried not to think about myself for just a couple minutes at the direction of my sponsor. I didn't come up with that by myself. And he gave me a job, and he took me out of the lame jobs I had. Living at my parents' house, I was working at a loading dock at night and then delivering packages during the day and going to meetings in between. And I got this job at an airline, and I went to this airline night after night, and I came home to my parents, and I started to realize that the work I was doing in AA was making me comfortable with people. I was going on the 12-step calls. I was doing everything that you guys asked me to do. I was showing up to meetings all the time, and I wasn't uncomfortable anymore. But I went to this job one night, and on my way to work in the afternoon, I bought a guitar. And it was the first new guitar I'd had in years, and I was paying the money back. I was making my amends, so I could do it. I felt clean doing it, and I got to work, and I realized at work, no one's going to care about this guitar at home. My mom and my dad don't want to hear about music. And I lived with them still, and I walked out to the bus stop that night thinking about that. It was 10:30 at night, and I looked. There was a woman standing next to me from another airline, British Airways, and I said, "Hey, can I show you my new guitar?" And she said, "I don't look at strange men's guitars," and kind of shut me down, you know. And I really was surprised by that, because I couldn't have been more innocent in her wanting her to see my guitar, to someone. To see how good it was and appreciate it and not have it just be for me. And we got in the bus, and I realized she thought I was trying to hit on her. And we were pushed together on the bus, and we had to talk about God, because she had a book in her hand called Surprised by Joy by C.S. Lewis. And I wanted her not to be nervous anymore, so I asked about the book, and I read the book, and we talked about it. And she didn't believe in God, and she asked me if I believed in God. And I said, "Well, I probably don't believe in the God that you don't believe in. But God changed my life." And when we got off that bus, I asked her out to dinner, and she said no. She didn't just say no. She said, "I've read that book. Look at my guitar. You know, that's not okay. I have to wait for this bus every day." And she was kind of hard on me. And I said, "You know, no is a complete answer." And I went home to my dad, and I didn't want him to cry about my mother that night. So I told him I met this girl, and she felt like home, and I blew it. And he was interested. He really got out of his own grief, and he talked to me really thoughtfully, and he said, "You know, I don't think that's over." And I went to work the next day, and I tried not to think about this beautiful woman who was so calming to me. And I really tried not to think about her, but I did. And I saw she was at work, so I wanted to not be on the same bus as her. So I ran to the earlier bus. I finished work as early as I could, and she came up behind me. I heard her high heels, and she tapped me on the shoulder and said, "I was rude to you last night. I don't want to go out with you." And I said, "No, you've been real clear about that." And she said, "But I'll have coffee with you tonight if you want to have coffee." And I knew what we were doing. She wanted to feel better about how she treated me the night before. And I just wanted to get to know her. I didn't have any other agenda. And we sat and had coffee, and we missed all the buses. And 2 weeks later, she proposed to me. And she's sitting in the other room. We've been together for 25 years. And the reason I tell you that is it has everything to do with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The fact that I diminished my loneliness and finally figured out who I really was in the ugly, raw nakedness of the fifth step. And the fact that I had the tool of the sixth and seventh step. You want to start to discover character defects? Marry someone. Have four children. It's not like, you know, I'm year 10 in AA, I graduated. I love it when people say I worked the steps. I'm like, what are you talking about? It's like I used my engine on my car. Your car is moving down the road. You're still using the engine, right? You know, I love Philippa Mitchell. I adore her. But if I didn't have this program, we would both be lost. You know, when I was married for 5 years, my wife had a massive stroke, a really massive stroke. She's completely paralyzed on the left side of her body. She's brain damaged. And we had two children. We had Phoebe with Anna. We had two children. Oh, and I wanted to say that. You know, when Phoebe and Anna you know, when my children were born with Philippa, the first people at the hospital were Phoebe and Anna. And then 5 years later, Pip had a stroke. And everything changed. But I kept surrendering. I kept looking for ways to get the help I needed. And grace showed up. I'll tell you about the night it happened. I called my sponsor early in the morning, like 3:30, 4 in the morning from the hospital when I was freaking out. Philip had a stroke. And he said, I need you to call my sponsor, Jay. And I didn't want to call his sponsor. And he said, I need you to call Jay. And so I hung up at 3:30 or 4 in the morning and I called Jay. And Jay woke up. And he said, what happened? And I told him, he goes, I need you to talk to my wife. And I went, hold the phone, man. I want to talk to my sponsor. You know, I don't know. I don't feel any. I can't do this. I have a 1-year-old, a 4-year-old, and an 8-year-old, you know, or a 5-year-old, an 8-year-old. I can't do this. And he said, I need you to talk to my wife. And he woke up Adele. And Adele listened. And she said, I've had 5 strokes. Let me tell you what your wife is feeling right now. And this is the gift of fellowship. Experience. The experience somebody has where they're paying attention and they can share with you. The curse of fellowship is opinion. But we don't, that's another hour-long talk. But that night, early in the morning, she said, let me tell you what she's thinking. And everything started to change in my head. I'm listening. Yeah, what's she thinking? How's she feeling? What's going through her mind? And she told me how scared she was, how out of control it feels, how powerless my wife was feeling. And then Jay got back on the phone and he said, you've always wanted to be the world's greatest lover. Now's your chance. I would not have had that advice from the people that I was drinking with before 1993. But I got that experience and that advice from the people who were living the life of spiritual action where material action came second, and they had paid attention and they filled in the potential of who they could be through the grace of God and told me valuable things. That one sentence, you've always wanted to be the world's greatest lover, now's your chance, has guided me for the last 18 years of caregiving. And we've adopted a child. We've raised, Phoebe's a nurse now. You know, I ran away from that hospital saying, God, make it so that I never see that child again. And I was playing with Phoebe a year later, paying child support, showing up, being kind to Anna, making amends every day. And I'm playing with Phoebe and Phoebe's bouncing on my lap. And I'm saying, Phoebe, I'm your dad. I'm going to take you to your first day of kindergarten. And I'm going to take you to your first day of first grade. And I'm going to buy you a car when you're 16, which was so funny that I'm saying that. I didn't even have a car when I was a year sober, but I'm going to buy you a car, you know, and when you're 16. And I was just so delighted. And I said, I'm going to pay for college. I don't know how I'm going to do it. I was so full of joy at being her dad. And a year before that, before I met you, my prayer was, God, please make it so that these two women never see me again. But because I came to a group of people that really took recovery seriously and really didn't take themselves that seriously and really knew to focus on my actions and ignore my thinking, I grew into a place where I was so in love with being Phoebe's dad, and that has never faltered. And being a parent is not easy. 6 and 7, 11, 12, all of it contributes to me becoming a better and better parent because they always move the cheese. Right when you figure out how to parent a 12-year-old, they turn 13. Right when you figure out how to be married to a disabled woman who's 35, 39, she turns 50. Her life changes. Everything changes. Everybody's perspective changes. And that's why the steps always change when you revisit them. They always get deeper and wider. They always rescue you. I did take Phoebe to her first day of kindergarten, and I cried like a baby. She was so beautiful. And I loved her so much. And then I took her to her first day of first grade and second grade and third grade, and I cried every time. In sixth grade, she held me by the shoulders and said, "Dad, you got to chill out. You're a little hard to understand with these people." She didn't want me to walk her into school crying again. And I bought her a car when she was 16 with her mom. And last year, I finished paying for nursing school. And Phoebe's out there helping people in this pandemic, in this global crisis. My little girl that I met on May 16th, 1993, is a 27-year-old woman, and she works 75 hours a week sometimes, right now. There is no way to describe what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. Just like I'm sure everyone on this call, I'm afraid to look at how many people that is. I'm sure there's no way to truly describe what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for you. It's a spiritual pattern, a way to live so I can be free, so I can escape the bondage of self, so I don't walk around grabbing. I walk around attempting to give. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous has become deeper and wider and stronger and more necessary in my life every year than it did the first 2, 3, 4, 5 years. I love being a member of AA. I'll leave with this. There was a guy who said in a meeting in January before we couldn't see each other in person, and he's a kind of a gruff guy who came from work, and he said, "You know what AA's taught me?" I'm going to tell you two different things I learned in meetings. He said, "You know what AA's taught me? It's that when you think about it, life kind of sucks. But when you live it, it's freaking awesome. It's amazing." And I don't think about being Philippa's husband. I just get to be Philippa's husband. I don't think about all these kids. I love them. I be with them. Well, I do think about it, but I participate. The thinking is the suffering. The living is the beauty. You know, it's just amazing. It's just amazing. I forgot the other thing I was going to tell you I learned at a meeting. I just sat in a room by myself and talked to myself nervously. And I hope that you heard from me what can happen here. I hope that you heard from me. I'm not giving you hope. I'm giving you my experience that grace is everywhere. It's everywhere. It is unfailing. And the only admission price is surrender. Thank you so much for inviting me to this extraordinary event. Thank you so much.